KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Do you assume something's wrong if the head of a charitable organization makes a really good salary? And do you suspect something might be amiss if a charitable organization spends money on glossy advertising and 40% of its budget on overhead? If so, Dan Pallotta wants to challenge your assumptions. In a new book, he argues that people who run charities should make good salaries, should advertise aggressively. And if it takes spending more on overhead to provide decent training and long-range planning, then so be it. In short, Pallotta argues that charities need to behave more like for-profit ventures. Challenging our charitable assumptions. Our topic next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Dan Pallotta thinks we have it all wrong when it comes to how charities operate. He says the prevailing model is one of a charity that just squeaks by, saving money on personnel and office overhead, pouring everything into direct services, and never, ever advertising. He thinks charities ought to take more of a for-profit approach, including paying their leaders top-flight salaries. After all, we think it's fine for people to make money in business. Why not people who help the poor? As he noted in a recent New York Times column, we allow people to make huge profits doing any number of things that hurt the poor, but we want to crucify anyone who wants to make money helping them. Dan Pallotta knows all about getting pilloried. His bike riding fundraisers for AIDS several years ago, for example, raised a ton of money and also paid Pallotta a handsome salary, a model that ran afoul of many in the AIDS activist community. This morning on Forum, we take up this question, whether or not charities ought to adopt a different operating model and in so doing better serve the people they seek to assist. Dan Pallotta's new book is called Uncharitable: How Restraints on Nonprofits Undermine Their Potential. Mr. Pallotta, good morning.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Happy to have you on. You challenge a lot of assumptions in your book, ranging from how much charities spend on advertising to overhead. But I want to ask first about this question of salaries, because it is what people challenged about some of your own work a number of years ago. And it's the one that makes people wonder, I think, first off, when they read perhaps in a news article about the head of some charitable organization, an example that doesn't happen that frequently, certainly, but someone who makes a ton of money, and they go, that's wrong. That just shouldn't be. That's money that ought to be going to the people who need it, not paying some executive a big salary. What's wrong with that assumption?
Well, look at the double standard between the nonprofit and the for-profit sector. The Chronicle of Philanthropy did a study that showed there were 52 nonprofit executives in 2004 making more than $1 million. 42 of them were at hospitals, which are quasi-businesses, leaving, you know, a statistic zero of the number of executives in charity making $1 million. I compared the salaries of the leaders of our health charities like the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation and the American Cancer Society and others with the CEOs of private health insurance companies. And the CEOs of private health insurance companies were making 72 times what the leaders of our charities are that are trying to cure these diseases. So it's a strange society that values the affordability of disease 72 times more than eradicating it. So I don't advocate for gratuitously paying people more in charity, but I do think that if we want to attract the best talent, then we have to remove these arbitrary prohibitions on salaries. You know, we ought to, instead of asking what a person makes and getting concerned about what a person makes, we ought to ask, what kind of person, what kind of team would it take to eradicate, let's say, breast cancer? And let's find those people and let's pay them whatever we have to pay them, so long as they're producing value.
One of the examples you cite in your book, I'll just read this briefly, is you write that Sony can make a profit from a Bruce Springsteen album that heightens awareness of the plight of migrant workers, but no one can earn a profit working for a charity trying to help the migrant workers of whose plight we want people to become more aware. So is it that fundamental contradiction to you that you most would like to change?
Well, people for some reason like to focus on the issue of executive compensation, but I'd like to kind of take a step back because the picture is much bigger than that. We have two rule books, economic rule books, one for charity and one for the rest of the economic world. And we allow the for-profit sector to use the powerful tools of capitalism. And we blame capitalism for creating all these inequities in our society. And then we refuse to allow charity to use the tools of capitalism to rectify those inequities. So we don't want people making a lot of money in charity, but people can make however much money they want to in business. And that sends all of the top potential talent coming out of the nation's best business schools and law schools and other schools directly into the for-profit sector. You brought up the issue of advertising. You know, we let the for-profit sector advertise until the last dollar no longer produces a penny of value. But we don't like to see our donated dollars spent on paid advertising and charity. So that means that charity can't build demand for causes. If I, for instance, said the music industry can advertise, but the movie industry cannot. Well, you're going to buy a lot more music than you are movies simply because you're not going to know what movies are playing. You know, I was driving on the way down here today and saw a billboard for Palm, you know, the pomegranate juice. Now, whoever wanted to drink pomegranate juice before they started that huge ad campaign? So they created this massive demand that Galbraith wrote extensively about in all consumer products for pomegranate juice. Well, we can create massive demand for ending AIDS and breast cancer and poverty and all those other things and dramatically increase charitable giving. But we can't do it if we don't allow charities to spend any dollars reaching us.
Give me an example of how that might work. Give me a sort of case study in if we took a sort of glossier approach, if you would, to advertising and making people aware of a particular cause, what that might net us?
Well, charitable giving has remained constant at about 2% of GDP for the last 30 years. So charity isn't gaining market share from the for-profit sector. And why? Because we don't want charity to spend money on what we call overhead. Well, we have to stop using this word overhead. Overhead is people. Overhead is new money spent to raise money. Overhead is organizational strength. So if we were to spend more money on fundraising and marketing and reaching out to people, reaching out to consumers the way that Apple does and Mercedes does and Amtrak does, then we could increase that percentage of giving. And you know, with an extra $300 billion, I mean that 2% represents $300 billion. With an extra $300 billion or $600 billion, then we could really start to make some progress on these problems. And that's the fundamental question we have to ask. What do we want of charity? Do we want it to just keep its head above water, or do we really want to solve some of these vexing social problems? Do we really want to see homelessness ended, period, in the city of San Francisco? You know, do we want to set an impossible goal for the end of AIDS in the next 10 years? If so, and we want to achieve those things, then we're going to have to give charity a whole new set of freedoms. I talked about compensation and advertising. There's also risk. You know, we don't want charities taking risk, but we don't mind if Paramount makes a $100 million movie that flops. So charities can't develop learning curves. You know, if you want to go out and produce a special event, it better have a 75% profit year one, or, you know, someone's going to call the attorney general. Well, that just petrifies charities. And so they can't develop learning curves for generating new revenue. Long-term Just two other quick things. We don't want charities to invest in the long term, but we don't mind if Amazon goes for 6 years without a profit trying to build market dominance. But if you had a hunger charity that had a six-year strategy with nothing going to the needy for 6 years, you know, again, a crucifixion. And the last thing is there's, by definition, no profit in the nonprofit sector. So that means no capital markets. The for-profit sector monopolizes the multi-trillion-dollar capital markets, and charity is left with the donation as its only financial instrument. So it goes way beyond executive compensation. It's compensation. It's the ability to take risk. It's the ability to market and advertise. It's the ability to think in the long term. And it's the ability to start to pay investors a financial return. Investors like your grandmother, you know, in her 401k, so that she could invest and save the children as much as in mobile. We have to give charity the same freedoms we give to business, or it doesn't have a hope.
Dan Pallotta, our guest this hour, his new book is called Uncharitable: How Restraints on Nonprofits Undermine Their Potential. Let's focus for a moment on one of those items that you just mentioned, because it's central to so much of your argument, I think, and that's this question of overhead. When we look at charities, in fact, when we think about making a charitable donation, one of the criteria we often look at is, well, what's their overhead? How much of their budget goes to direct services and how much goes to overhead? And we tend to think that the smaller the overhead, the better, because that means that the dollar that I'm going to give, 90% of that dollar, is going to go to help people as opposed to, you know, paying for the new fax machine or whatever. Your argument is that's really the wrong question. That's really the wrong way to look at it, because you need to have overhead if you're going to think bigger. Walk us through how that would work.
Well, we've been trained to ask the wrong question. We ask, what percentage of my donation goes to the cause, ad nauseum? There was a study done by Princeton Survey Research for the Better Business Bureau. 70% of respondents said they want to know what percentage of their money goes to the cause. Only 6% of respondents said they want to know if their money makes a difference, presumably because they think the two things are the same, but they're not. Let me give you an example. You have two soup kitchens. One says 90 cents on your dollar goes back to the cause. So you think, wow, that's really efficient. The other one says only 70 cents on your dollar goes back to the cause. And you think, oh, that's inefficient. I'm going to give to the 90 cents soup kitchen. But then let's go behind the scenes, and you find that the 90-cent soup kitchen serves rancid soup in a dilapidated facility with a burnt-out staff, and the 70% soup kitchen has a state-of-the-art facility. They serve really hearty, nutritious soup, and they have a friendly staff that does case management. Well, now you'd want to give to the 70% charity. You would never have known that if all you asked is what percentage of my donation goes to the cause. You would have given to the wrong charity. And because we have put the focus on overhead and not on progress and not on results, charities have become obsessed with keeping their, quote, overhead low. And one of the ways they do it is by redefining the cause. So there's all this gaming of the system going on, where one charity will take 50% of its expenses and say, we're going to call that part of the cause, because that will show consumers that we're much more efficient. But in fact, they're no more efficient than the other charity that isn't doing it. So it's a horrible system. That question also discriminates against lesser known causes, right? It's relatively easy to raise money for a cause like breast cancer, relatively inexpensive because so many people have lost friends to breast cancer. But try raising money for, you know, some obscure disease. Well, you're going to have to spend a lot of money educating people about that disease. Now, we call that overhead, but that's the only thing the charity could conceivably spend money on. That charity isn't less efficient. They're just less well known.
And as part of your argument also, Dan Pallotta, that it basically takes money to raise money. So that one of the things you were criticized for in the AIDS rides, for example, was that your overhead was, let's say, 40%. And that sounds really high. But your argument is, look, if I raise $100 million, $60 million is still going to the cause. If I way lower my overhead and it looks better on paper, I'm not going to raise as much overall.
Absolutely. You know, there again is that stigmatizing word overhead. Overhead. Well, what was that overhead? Well, we had 400 full-time employees, and they were spending all of their time talking about AIDS and talking about breast cancer and talking about suicide prevention. they weren't overhead. You know, they were educating people about the cause, and they were raising massive amounts of money. And you have to look at, you know, it takes money to raise money. It also takes money to raise money quickly. We raised $500 million in 9 years. It was more money raised more quickly for AIDS and breast cancer than any private event operation in history. And if you have AIDS or you have breast cancer, you want a cure to come quickly. You don't want it to come 50 years down the road. And, you know, yes, if you spent no money on advertising over the course of 30 years, word of mouth might build your event up to $10 million. Well, do we want to wait 30 years to cure all of these problems? No, I don't think so. So, yes, you have to spend money on things like training, on things, you know, and we spent, here's an ironic thing. We spent tens of millions of dollars on paid advertising, right? And that was how we recruited so many people so quickly. The media made more of a profit off of our existence than we did. Like on a typical event budget, we would be getting a fee of $370,000 and we would be paying $500,000 for paid media. And then the media was criticizing us for earning a profit when they, in fact, were earning a bigger profit off of our work, and we were just handing them the business, you know. So, yeah, but we have to stop using this word overhead. I have a chapter in the book called Overhead is a Fiction. Unless there's fraud going on, 100% of your donation is being spent on the cause in whatever way the charity feels it can most intelligently advance the cause. That might be on a great CEO. That might be on a good facility. That might be on fundraising that could quadruple the amount of money coming to the cause over the course of the next 5 years. Business does not look at it as a zero-sum game when you take money away from, you know, a program to spend on long-term development. But we do in charity, and we have to stop that.
Go back to the year 2002 when you were running the bike rides for AIDS, which were very successful in terms of the amount of money they raised. But they also caused a lot of division within the AIDS community and the activist community in particular. The San Francisco AIDS Foundation broke off with your organization, saying that you'd cost too much. And it caused a lot of bitterness. And there was this sense, and you were accused particularly of being too, that it was too much about you, that it was too self-promotional. How do you respond to that? Because if you take that more aggressive Lexus sort of approach, as you term it at one point in your book, you're going to also open up the door to that sort of criticism that is too much about you as opposed to the people you're trying to help.
Well, you're going to open up that criticism if we don't change our thinking. But, you know, we need social entrepreneurs. We need Henry Fords and Steve Jobs in the world of charity, and we need to celebrate those kinds of people. We've, you know, at least in the academic circles and the Stanford Social Innovation Review, and we've come some distance in terms of understanding the need for doing well and doing good. But when we were doing this work in 1994 and 1996, you know, there was no lexicon for social entrepreneurship. There wasn't anybody talking about doing well and doing good. So, you know, my company and the San Francisco AIDS Foundation and the LA Gay and Lesbian Center, you know, we were all doing something new that was extremely successful, very rapidly, extremely successful. And we were getting all of this external pressure, all of us. So, you know, I think we were all together blazing a new trail, and we were uncovering what public opinion was like. And, you know, that's kind of what's led to this book, is seeing all of the counterproductive ways we've been taught to think about charity.
And would your response also be, in part, for someone who would say to you, look, it's just not, it's immoral to make money off of the cause that you're trying to champion, would your response be, in part, well, is it more moral to make less money? In other words, you have to take, your argument, I assume, is you have to take some of those more aggressive approaches to serve the greater good, and that we need to keep our eyes on that prize.
Well, there are all kinds of people out in the world making $1 million not doing any social good. How can you say it's immoral to make $1 million and do social good? I don't understand that. You know, and Would you say it's more moral not to hire the person who could eradicate breast cancer and just, you know, unilaterally make that decision based on your morality and let hundreds of thousands of women die of breast cancer? I don't see how that's moral. It's immoral to me.
Let me ask you about another aspect of what you focus on, because it's also less talked about but seems important in some ways, and in a sense gets back to this overhead question. And that's how people are trained to do good work. If you had someone who wants to go into business or, you know, wants to be a manager, wants to be an executive, are the odds for that person being developed, being trained, being groomed, being mentored better in business or better in a charitable organization? And I think I know which way you're going to go with that question, yeah. but talk us through why that's important in terms of who works in these particular places.
Yeah, it's much better in business because business has the ability to spend money on leadership development and on job training and actually retain people. The nonprofit sector, that's frowned upon. As much as an executive director might like to spend money on those things, it's going to get labeled as overhead, so he or she has to go without them. So, you know, you have these high rates of turnover in the nonprofit sector. And then, you know, compensation's a big issue. In my book, I wrote about how 10 years out of business school, at the age of 38, the average Stanford Business School graduate is earning $400,000. Now, that's about as much as any of the CEOs of the major health charities in America at the age of 38, with many years of much more earning potential ahead of them. There's just no way you're going to get those people to make that kind of economic sacrifice. It's cheaper for them to donate $100,000 a year to charity.
On the other hand, we've also learned, if we learn nothing else in 2008, that highly paid executives don't necessarily equate to good performance. Look at everything that happened on Wall Street.
No, absolutely. And I don't advocate gratuitously upping everybody's salary in charity. I think that compensation ought to be tied to value. And if you can demonstrate that you can produce value, you ought to be compensated for it. And you ought not be prohibited from earning a higher salary if you're producing greater value, because that's only going to send you into the for-profit sector.
What about those who would say, look, there are plenty of people who are public school teachers, who work in various helping professions, who work for an organization like Save the Children, which you mentioned earlier, or Doctors Without Borders, who are out there doing good deeds, not making much, but they stay the course. They keep their shoulder to the wheel, and that for them it's not about money, that in fact that's not what motivates people, that you're not really focusing on the things that bring people the most into those sorts of careers and concerns.
Well, again, let's just take the salary issue out of the picture for a second, and let's say we're not going to allow anybody to make any more money in charity. Let's just keep salaries where they are and keep the leadership that we have. Okay, even with that, we have these other prohibitions that hamstring those good people who are in charity right now. They can't spend serious money building demand for their causes. They can't take any risks, so they can't develop institutional learning curves. They can't make investments in the long term, so they're stuck with a short-term focus. And they can't pay anyone a profit, so they can't raise the kind of capital that they would need to scale their organizations up to the size of the problem. So even if you push the salary issue aside and say, I don't care about the salary issue, there is still this huge economic apartheid between the nonprofit sector and the for-profit sector.
Dan Pallotta, our guest this hour, his new book is called Uncharitable: How Restraints on Nonprofits Undermine Their Potential. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll take your calls as well. How would you like to see charities operate differently, particularly in a time of tough economy like now? What is it that they ought to be doing different to be able to serve people in a greater and more effective way? Here's the number if you want to join in our conversation. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us your thoughts at forum@kqed.org, forum@kqed.org. Back with Dan Pallotta in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, Dan Pallotta, his new book is called Uncharitable: How Restraints on Nonprofits Undermine Their Potential. We welcome your participation in our conversation, too. If ever there were a time when we would like charitable nonprofit organizations to function well, now would be that time. And we welcome your thoughts on that topic. How can they function best in this difficult economic circumstance? Our number is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. And let's go right to our calls. David joins us first in Marin County this morning. David, you're on.
Hi, good morning. First of all, I couldn't agree more with your author. This is one of the most exciting programs I've heard. I'm an executive director of a nonprofit up in the North Bay, and I think there are a couple issues. One is I think there's this culture of martyrs that exists both within the nonprofit sector as well as within the sort of philanthropic donor world, in that everybody expects everyone to suffer on within the nonprofit. I think we confuse the staff of the nonprofit serving, let's just say, low-income people with the low-income community that's being served. You know, one side is needs help and the other side is trying to actually build a career. And if we're not careful, the staff of the nonprofits will end up being clients when they retire. So they do need to be compensated so that they, you know, at the time that they've dedicated their lives and their careers to helping, that they don't end up in a food line, for example. And the last thing I just want to say is I've thought about this salary issue a lot as I get asked often, you know, what our salary structure is. What I've come up with is there's really no right answer. You know, I mean, you almost want to say, well, what do you think an appropriate salary is for somebody working in this field? Because, you know, it's sort of like guess a number between 1 and 10, 5, too high, too low. You never get it right.
David, thanks. Thanks for the call and observation and participation in both the work that you do as well as in our program this morning. Dan Pallotta, comment on David's point about the culture of martyrdom. Do you agree with that assessment and contrast it, if you would, to a place perhaps like Google or Apple or somewhere else and why that culture matters?
Yeah, I actually spent 6 months researching the early Puritan settlers to New England, trying to understand where did this mindset come from. And the Puritans came here as capitalists. You know, they wanted to make a lot of money, and wealth was actually a sign that you were right with God. But they were also Calvinists and taught that they were despicable in the eyes of God. So charity became this separate economic sanctuary where they could do penance for their profit-making tendencies. And so, of course, you couldn't make money in charity. How could you make money in charity if charity was your penance for making money? And 400 years have flown by, and we really haven't thought much about this, but we have to. You know, why would you want a different attitude about compensating people to get food on everybody's plate than you would for getting sneakers on everybody's feet? So, your caller brings up an excellent point. There was a big brouhaha at the James Irvine Foundation back in 2002 because they were paying the head of the foundation several $100,000 a year. And one nonprofit executive director said, "This is terrible. This is money that was meant for the people of California, poor people." See, it's always seen as a zero-sum game, that money paid to the executive director is money taken away from the poor. Well, it isn't if that executive director can raise 10 times the amount of money for the poor. Then it's an investment in the poor, and that's how we have to look at it. You know, the CEO, Andrea Jung, the CEO of the Avon Cosmetics company, her 2007 compensation was $11 million. Wouldn't we want to pay somebody $11 million a year to eradicate breast cancer? I think we have to reverse the question. Instead of asking, what's the appropriate salary, we have to ask, what's the objective? Then we can figure out what the appropriate salary is. How much would you be willing to pay someone who could end homelessness in San Francisco? Let's start with our dreams. We've forgotten about our dreams. We've forgotten about our vision. We've forgotten about the reasons that charities were structured in the first place and gotten completely obsessed with overhead and salaries. We ought to get obsessed with how can we eradicate some of these social problems and what will it take to do it.
Kevin in Santa Rosa has our next question and point. Kevin, go ahead.
Hi, yes. It's a very interesting topic and very thought-provoking. But, you know, I agree with a lot of the gentleman's points, but I keep asking two questions, you know, from myself, and I'd like to ask the questions from him, is if you introduce the profit motive into charitable organizations, what is it to prevent charitable organizations from being motivated by greed and the individuals who run them being motivated by greed, because those two go hand in hand always?
Yep, Kevin, thank you. Good, fair question. Dan Pilato, go ahead.
You know, I speak to a lot of young people in their mid-20s, a few years out of college, and they want to make a difference, but they also want to have a family. So they work for a year or two in the nonprofit sector, and then they decide they have to get serious about their lives and their economic future. And we have to stop giving young people those kinds of mutually exclusive choices. Yep, you know, some people are greedy and some people are criminal, and that happens in the corporate world and that happens in charity. As well, I don't think that we ought to deny the nonprofit sector the powerful tools of self-interest simply because there are a few bad apples who are going to for the, whom that's going to be problematic.
Mary in El Cerrito is next. Mary, go ahead.
Hi, this is an amazing conversation. Thank you very much. My comment is it's tied in with, you know, how we compensate the leadership of these charities. I just want to say that to attract more donors, it's very critical to demonstrate value as a charity and to be accountable for the money that you're given. So, for example, two charities that I know of that do a very good job of that is Compassion International, which is sponsoring little children from poverty-stricken areas, and they hook you up one-on-one so you can write letters to them and see how your money is changing their life. And the other one, of course, is the San Francisco-based Kiva.org, which is person-to-person microlending. And I think if charities did a better job of showing where your money goes and demonstrating the value of your money, I think they could get a lot more money from donors like me.
Mary, thank you. Excellent point. Dan Pilato, talk about that some, because this goes to your point about keeping focused on performance and about whether or not a particular charitable organization is making a difference. She mentioned Kiva and the work that they're doing in terms of microfinance so that you can help out. If you want to help someone who's striving to create a business in a third world nation, you can provide that directly. I guess my question is, for people who are interested in looking at that question as opposed to the overhead question, how do you go about it? How do you figure out whether or not a particular organization is indeed making a difference?
This is a problem. We have no major national apparatus that allows consumers to evaluate the efficacy of charitable programs, and we need one. We need to make a serious investment in that kind of apparatus. Right now, essentially what we have are three watchdog agencies: the Better Business Bureau's Wise Giving Alliance, the American Institute for Philanthropy, and Charity Navigator. Between them, they have annual budgets of about $5 million. They have total staff of 30 to 40 people. The largest of them, Charity Navigator, has reports on 5,000 charities. There are over 1 million charities in the United States. So we are spending $5 million, essentially nothing, to evaluate $300 billion worth of annual giving. What we need is a national apparatus made up of teams of surveyors that can go out to charities on an annual basis, write narratives about the work they're doing, about their dreams, about their challenges, take video of clients and executive staff, put that all online on an iTunes-like friendly user interface so that you and I can go online and find out not just financial information about these charities, but what are they up to? What have they achieved in the last year? What are they hoping to achieve in the next year? That, you know, we should spend about 0.5% of the money we give away to make sure that the money we give away is intelligent. And I think that that's something that the Obama administration should make a top priority, and quickly establishing a super database for charity in the United States so that there's transparency, so that public confidence can rise up. NYU did a study last year. 70% of respondents said that they believe charities waste either a great deal or a fair amount of money. Yet there have been no studies done showing that charities actually do waste a lot of money. Why does the public feel this way then? Well, it's because all we ever talk about is overhead. You know, it's like if I tell you don't think of a striped pink elephant, that's the first thing you're going to think about. Well, if the only thing we ever talk about is overhead, the public is going to conflate overhead and charity all the time. So we need a sophisticated apparatus so that people can evaluate charity. And Kiva is wonderful, but it's not applicable to every social problem. You know, if you have a group of organizations trying to address systemic poverty on Skid Row, I'm not going to be able to make a loan to one person on Skid Row to solve that problem. So, you know, there needs to be a more sophisticated evaluation of what progress means for, you know, poverty in Skid Row versus a farmer who wants to, you know, buy four more cows in India and increase his business.
The point of transparency is one of our emailers wrote in. Eugene writes, I'm all for what Dan Pallotta is talking about, so long as complete transparency exists for all records, transactions, etc. This must be a legal requirement, and there also ought to be, he notes, some sort of adversarial oversight to keep check on this. So on this question of transparency, I mean, you're advocating it in terms of being able to really understand and see what an organization actually does. Eugene, who wrote in, who also is saying, if we're going to pay the leaders of these organizations more, if we're going to allow them to take more risks and follow the approaches you're suggesting, it all has to be transparent. You'd agree with that, right?
Absolutely. I would agree with that. See, the difference between charity and the for-profit sector is when you go out and you buy an iPhone, well, you have transparency in your hand. You know exactly where that money went and how it works and how the product works and what its features are. Charity, you know, you're several distances away from what your money bought. So it's critical that we have transparency and not just on dangerous, misleading things like overhead, but on
what they actually do.
Yeah, what they actually do. Yeah. And being able to compare CEO salary. You ought to be able to know what the CEO's salary is, but if it's $800,000, don't say that's a bad charity. Find out what's this woman achieving for $800,000 a year. She might be cheap.
Barbara in San Francisco is next. Barbara, go ahead.
Thank you. Very interesting program. I have both a comment and a question. My comment is that for most nonprofits, as I think Mr. Pallotta knows, education is not considered overhead. It's programmed, so it wouldn't be counted as overhead when people are looking at those percentages. But my question is actually related to the transparency issue you've been talking about. With all the money that Mr. Pallotta talked about raising for breast cancer and AIDS, can he tell us how many cases were cured? That's transparency.
Well, we were doing fundraising, so our transparency was about, you know, how much money is going to the cause. You can still go on PallottaTeamworks.com, and for every single event we produced, you can find out how much money we raised, you can find out how much we spent on advertising, you can find out what our company's production fee was. So, you know, we had very granular detail on every aspect of every event, and it wasn't required by law. We weren't a charity, and we weren't in the grant-making business. So it was the job of the charities that we were giving money to try and find a cure for breast cancer. And actually, if I had to do it over again, I would probably create some kind of a hybrid business where we were not only raising the money, but we were the custodians of the money as well, and we were making the grants so that we could make decisions. Since we were the interface with the consumer about where that money's going to go and have it go to really bold, maverick places and measure what's actually happening after the money leaves our door. But that's a fascinating question because we don't evaluate that.
Yeah.
As I said before, all we ask is what percentage of my donation goes to the cause? And then we don't care what that money bought or what that money did.
This reminds me a bit of what the Michael J. Fox Foundation has tried to do with Parkinson's research. When he created that foundation, he did so, he says, in part because he wanted to create a different model for how a charitable foundation works. He says he wanted to build it low to the ground and fast, and he specifically hired people from business to run it, to try to raise money quickly, get it out the door quickly, aimed at, sometimes risky, but those things that might make a difference the quickest for people with that particular sort of condition. So it was a very different, more entrepreneurial sort of enterprise. And that's part of what you're arguing, too, that most charities tend to be too risk-averse, right?
Well, they tend to be risk-averse on the fundraising side, and this is a critical distinction. See, what Michael J. Fox is doing is wonderful. You can take all kinds of risks on the science side, and that's money that went to the cause. You know, if you take a huge research risk, you spend $10 million on a research risk and it fails, you still tell your donors $10 million went to the cause. On the other hand, if you spend $10 million trying to create, say, a new special event that could raise $100 million, and that fails, that $10 million gets counted largely as overhead. And so charities don't want to take risks in that area. Hmm. And that's the most critical area, because if they can't expand, you know, you can have all the great ideas in the world programmatically, but if you don't have the capital to scale them up, you know, forget about it. The Grameen Foundation in the U.S. is separate from Grameen in Bangladesh. It's ironic. Grameen can use the tools
of capitalism.
For
those who aren't familiar, sorry to interject, but this is the microfinancing organization for which Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize. Go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah. Sorry for not explaining that. The Grameen Foundation in the U.S. can use the tools of capitalism to help the poor, but it can't use the tools of capitalism to help itself. It has to go to great pains, even in its own annual report, to tell its donors how little it spends on overhead. Well, if it could spend more on overhead, again, I hate that word, which would mean, you know, growth capital and risk-taking to raise more capital, then it could apply its model at a much greater scale. And it's not just the Grameen Foundation. This is every nonprofit in the United States has to be extremely risk-averse when it comes to new ways of raising money. And that means it's not going to find new ways of raising money. Mm.
Back to our calls. TJ in Sunnyvale is up next. TJ, go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
You bet.
Listening to this sort of for-profit model of a charitable giving makes me think of the Gates Foundation and how they identified malaria as an orphan disease mm-hmm. that the for-profit model wasn't working for. Could the speaker please address why hasn't a for-profit corporation already been formed with standing in the way of a for-profit charity?
Well, I think one of the reasons is the tax code. If I wanted to set up, let's say, a suicide prevention charity and run it as a for-profit, donations to it would not be tax deductible. So that's a huge problem. So, and I think that we need to look at the tax code, not only on that front, but so that we can create a stock market for charity. If you could make as much of a return off of an investment in Oxfam America and Amnesty International as you could in Mercedes-Benz and, Apple, then the general public, the investing public, would start to divert significant resources into the nonprofit sector, and that would come with fewer restrictions. That would be growth capital that those charities could use to scale up their operations. So the biggest difference between the nonprofit sector and the for-profit sector is that word non. You know, profit comes from the Latin for to advance or to progress. So we're literally saying no advancement, no progress when we say nonprofit. If we could take that restriction away and let growth capital start to flow into the nonprofit sector, we could start to solve some of these problems.
But that is a fundamental public policy shift that would seem hard to change. Alex writes in about that, too. He writes, there's nothing wrong with the premise Mr. Pallotta makes. However, citizens give to charities due to their tax-exempt status. So giving has a public subsidy that demands social responsibility yeah. on the part of those people who are managing those tax-exempt charities.
Yeah, absolutely. And you wouldn't get a tax deduction for an investment in Save the Children, because that would be a for-profit investment. And we might have to look at the tax code in terms of not making the organization tax exempt to the extent that it takes in donations, to the extent that it takes in investment capital. So let's say a charity takes in 20% of its money from a stock market and 80% from donations. Maybe 20% of its income becomes is no longer tax exempt. So we would have to look at the tax code. But you would have a hard time arguing that we wouldn't solve more social problems if the nonprofit sector didn't have access to the $30 trillion household financial capital markets.
Colin writes in with another question that he'd like you to address, Dan. He writes, my experience with natural history museums has shown me that the problem isn't paying the director enough. Often the director is highly paid. The problem is that the pay scale drops off very steeply from the top individuals to the rest of the organization. That causes resentment, lack of loyalty to the institution, and a certain class distinction between the top officers and everyone else.
In the nonprofit sector, the problem is on both sides of the coin. As I said earlier, you know, there are less than a handful of nonprofit executive directors making $1 million, and there are tens of thousands of them in the for-profit sector. Interestingly, there were a couple of battles for living wages in a couple of cities that I studied, and guess who came out against the living wage for their own organizations? Nonprofit organizations. They came out against the living wage because it meant that their wages were going to have to go up and their overhead was going to be higher.
Well, on that topic, let's go to Rose in Santa Rosa, who has a question about the martyrdom issue we were talking about earlier. Rose, go ahead.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. We've been talking a lot about donors and donor concerns for transparency. I was in a leadership program for developing, for people going into nonprofits. One of our mentors was making well over six figures, and the other trainees were just appalled to find out about that. So I was wondering about this question of resistance to change inside of organizations, resistance to, the idea that you have to be an idealist in order to go into a nonprofit.
Rose, thank you.
Yeah, I don't see being an idealist and wanting a good economic future for yourself as being at odds. A lot of people do. And it's part of the reason the major reason I wrote this book is we have to begin to deconstruct this Puritan ethic. It's antique. It doesn't work anymore. It was useful in the days of neighbor-to-neighbor assistance, but we are now asking charity, and perhaps we shouldn't even call it charity anymore. We are asking the nonprofit sector to tackle huge, global, complicated problems. And if we don't allow them the same tools and talent as the for-profit sector has for getting a video game on everybody's television set, then we're never going to solve these problems. So again, I come back to, we have to start from a larger context. We have to ask, what are our dreams? What do we want to achieve in this society? Do we want to eradicate some of these problems while we're still alive? The Puritans didn't. They saw the division between the rich and the poor as divine, something that God had ordered. Well, that's not the way we look at the world anymore, so maybe we oughtn't be using their model for charity anymore either.
Are there any other models out there? Does anyone in another country, in another part of the globe, do this in a way that is more effective?
Well, I mean, India is doing some interesting things. Obviously, what Grameen did, they circumvented the nonprofit construct, and what Muhammad Yunus did was done as a for-profit. It was a bank. Also, BRAC, which is doing development work in India. I think it's the largest charity in the world. Buys a lot of for-profit businesses and creates revenue streams off of that. But you see a lot of this, a lot of the Clinton Global Initiative, people circumventing the nonprofit sector, people talking about compassionate capitalism. And that's fine. And social entrepreneurs in a for-profit setting can do very interesting things to impact social problems. But we can't leave the nonprofit sector behind with this old set of rules. It's a massive amount of money, $300 billion a year. The sector as a whole is $1 trillion a year when you include government contracts and fees for service. Well, that's way more money than anything that Gates has or the Clinton Global Initiative has or any of the social entrepreneurial upstarts have. So we have to go into that sector where all of the money is change the paradigm, change the rules, set it free, set its potential free. And we can really, I really believe we can change the world. There's so much potential in the nonprofit sector, and it is so locked up and bound up by all of these restrictions. If we took those restrictions off, the most unbelievable things could begin to happen.
Let's squeeze in one more call from Jim in Mountain View. Jim, I'm afraid we just have a moment, so just a brief question, please.
If that was a slide, I...
Hello?
Oh, sorry, we lost our caller. We'll go ahead and get one more caller in. And let's go to that caller now. Go ahead, please. Aaron in Oakland.
Hi. Okay, my point is real quick. I'd rather that the policy go in the opposite direction to make the business world more nonprofit rather than make the nonprofit world more like a business. And, for example, single-payer nonprofit healthcare would decommercialize healthcare and so that people could make a living but not make a killing.
Aaron, thanks. Thanks for the call and the observation. Dan Pallotta, last thought, either on Aaron's point or what you'd most like to take us forward into the new year with. We've just come through what we like to call the season of giving. As we move in to 2009, what do you think people should be focused on as terms of how they make the charitable organizations they either work for or would like to support that much more effective?
They should be focused on a new world. They should be focused on new ideas, and they should be focused on what our dreams are. What would we as a society over the course of the next 25 to 50 years like to accomplish? What diseases would we like to end? What social problems would we like to eradicate? And let's start focusing on that and devote all of our energy and all of our resources toward that and create a system that will allow it to happen instead of being dragged around by a system that won't allow any of it to happen.
Dan Pallotta, our guest this hour. His new book is called Uncharitable, How Restraints on Nonprofits Undermine Their Potential. Dan, thanks very much for spending the hour with us today.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, pleasure to have you on. Fascinating topic. Dan Pallotta, again, the book Uncharitable, How Restraints on Nonprofits Undermine Their Potential. Coming up Monday morning on Forum with Michael Krasny, in the opening hour, Michael will talk with Stephen Greenhouse of the New York Times about his new work on whether the future of unions will be different under the Obama administration. And then in the second hour, Michael will be talking about opera, looking at a new collection of short stories about that topic. That comes up Monday morning on Forum with Michael Krasny. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer this past hour is Dave Freeman, and the executive producer of Forum is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.